The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I'm interested in today is probably different than what you're interested in. That's not quite right. What I'm interested in is I'm interested in what you're interested in. You're interested in what I say, maybe, but I'm interested in what you're interested in. So, with that idea, I'd like to hear what kind of questions you have about Buddhist practice, and I'll try to respond the best I can, and we can have a morning of kind of questions and answers. And if no one has any interest, then we can sit here quietly, peacefully.
In lieu of that, the other day you were talking about when the Buddha was dying, and he gave instructions, or he wanted to share what the important teachings were. Did I miss it? Was I napping, or did you? did he not mention the Four Noble Truths?
Yes.
Was that right? Was it right out of the box? Because there was a number of lists, I just don't remember ever having that come up on that list that you read.
The Eightfold Path is on the list, but so that includes the Four Noble Truths. But the Four Noble Truths weren't included in the list, and explicitly, it's a list that's called the 37 Wings of Awakening, and in a way. The Four Noble Truths can be seen, and I don't know why it's not listed there, except that the 37 wings are much more seen as practices and qualities of mind that come up through practice. And so the Four Noble Truths can be seen as practices, or they can be seen as insights or understandings that come from doing the practice. So these 37, the Four Noble Truths kind of the heart of what the Buddha had to teach. And it said that's what the Buddha discovered the night of his awakening. The Four Noble Truths, and these practices and these qualities of mind that come into play when we practice spiritual qualities, they're the ones that allow us to both to understand the Four Noble Truths in a way that's penetrating. That's my guess.
Yeah, I just thought it was odd.
Thank you.
Hi. Some time ago, you gave a talk about. I think the Buddha's disciple, one of them, was saying that friendship was half of the path, and the Buddha replied, no, it's all of the path. Could you just talk about that, please? That's what's on my mind.
Great, but say a little bit more why you're interested in this topic, so I won't go on in a great discourse about the Pali meaning of these words. And
great. I didn't want to know about Pali. I'm thinking about wishing and wanting and how it creates suffering, and love with a friend has elements of wishing and wanting, but it also lets go, I think, of wishing and wanting sometimes and accepts what is. And it just seems to me that friendship can be a very good lesson in the path.
Yeah, I mean, I have an article right now about friendship, right, in our newsletter.
Ah, well, I should just go and read that.
Yeah. I could read it. But wishing and wanting, that sticks in my mind, wishing and wanting. You're interested in how those play out in friendship?
Wishing and wanting can lead to desire and clinging and grasping.
Yes.
Okay, you just want me to talk about what's really going on, don't you?
if you can do it briefly.
So wishing and wanting can lead you down paths that bring you to suffering, and friendship can bring you down to paths that bring you to suffering. but so can it also bring you to release.
Right. I think so. So I don't think that friendship in and of itself can bring suffering. But it's the desires, the wanting, the wishing, expectations, demands that we have, that we add on to the friendship.
Yeah.
And so to understand, we shouldn't be rejecting friendship, but we should understand how we engage in friendship. And there's many different ways. I think that the healthiest forms of friendship is where we're friendly. And our expectation that we have is that we offer our friendship, not that we get friendship back. And now some friendships, certain friendships or relationships come with, after a time, with a certain level of mutual agreed commitments, relationships that are involved in that. And so people have to follow through on those agreements, those arrangements, if that's mutually agreed on. But to have those, to have expectations or desires of what those agreements are, without that being explicit, is very dangerous. So I think the best place to start is start with a focus on your capacity to be friendly, and not on what you get in return. And I think the cleanest friendships are when there's no need for any friendship to be returned. So that way we're not using our friendships to fill the psychological needs that we have that are better met other ways, for example, in our own practice. Now, it's unrealistic to go into a friendship and not have psychological needs and all these, psychological issues that come up. And ideally, you'd have a friendship that had enough honesty in the relationship where you could talk about it, that comes up. So I have certain needs in my life, and how do you think this is going to play out in our relationship? Is this a place where that need can be met, or can we, or not? And then there's an honest discussion about it. And then you understand where it's at. But there, it can be, one of the very, very difficult things in friendships is, especially in romantic friendships, is where people have completely different expectations of what's involved. They assume they have the same understanding, but it's very, very different. And so, because it's different expectations, the desires or the expectations of what is a reasonable relationship back and forth is so different that people very quickly are at odds with each other. My favorite example of this is there was a study done right after World War II of, they noticed that American servicemen in England reported that their English girlfriends were very quick to get into bed. And they noticed also that the English women reported that these American servicemen were very quick and wanted to get into bed. So they thought, this is a little odd. They both complained about each other, kind of. And so they did a study, as I understand from the study, where they studied and they found that in both cultures, the English and American cultures back then, there were 12 steps in courting. But apparently in the English, I don't remember the details, so you have to apologize, just make, In the English system, something like kissing was like number 3 or something. And before you get to bed. And in the American system, in the American system, kissing was early, but in the English system, kissing was like step 11. So the American servicemen would kiss these English women, and they were just kissing. they were getting ready for stage 4, whatever that was. But the English women said, oh, I've been kissed. I better make a quick decision here. Because we're at stage 11 here. So I apologize, I don't remember the details exactly right, but so expectations. So if unstated expectations can lead to tremendous problems. And so it's good to talk about things. And in general, with the romantic friendships, I think the slower they develop, the healthier they'll be.
And I just think that there's a real spiritual growth aspect to friendship.
Oh, definitely. Oh, absolutely. And the more honesty there can be, the more I think that the spiritual friendship side can develop. And then we have to be very careful that there can be such a great advantage in having spiritual friendships that there can be such a powerful longing for it. And that longing gets confused for other things. So the longing comes with demands, expectations, and it can be too much for our friends to have. So again, even though it can be tremendous benefit from it, how do we hold it lightly and not add our demands, our expectation, your forcefulness to it? And one of the things that I found, at least in the way my life has worked, the way I work, is that these things best operate kind of as they grow kind of organically from a shared life together, not by design. Let's say I'm going to, you know, make you my spiritual friend. Let's, you know, do it. It's more like you share a life together, a shared, you know, practice place together, and slowly it grows. There's many ways of it developing. I'm not going to say there's any way, but please, spiritual friendship is very useful.
I started to read a bit more about the Buddha, and I ran across a section where he essentially said, well, if you have a family and children, you're a householder, and if you're a householder, well, you can't really attain enlightenment. So,
really? He said that?
Good care of your family, and maybe you'll be reincarnated the next time around. Something of that.
Really?
That was the interpretation, you know, from this author.
Oh, authors.
I can't read Pali.
Sorry?
I can't read Pali. My question is, my struggle is practice versus being a householder. And I know you're a householder. Is there any hope? I know that we have householder retreats here, but between my work and my family, I can never make it to those either. So I would be very interested in any guidance you would offer on the way for that.
Well, first, a kind of footnote is that there were, in the time of the Buddha, lay disciples of his who attained awakening. So it's possible. You know, in the Buddha's teaching, his time, it was clearly understood that that could be possible. And nowhere that I know the Buddha say what you just quoted. Later in Buddhism, you know, is a very wide-ranging tradition with lots of strange ideas in it. There's no shortage of it. Like, you know, I think I notice some religions have that issue, that there's strange ideas in the corners of it. And Buddhism is just like that. And so there is, so the idea, so I've heard that kind of idea, but I have never heard it attributed to the Buddha. So so my interest in you asking that question is, what is it that you want from your Buddhist practice? You know.
Greater mindfulness, less reactivity, more peacefulness.
So those things can all be attained through a lay life, through a household life with kids and family. And the circumstances of your life then become your place for training. It's not so easy for you to go off to come here, to go to retreats. So what you need to do is to figure out how to actually take on your ordinary life as a place of practice. And, you know, how is it that when you are with your kids, you know, and maybe disciplining them, how do you do it so there's mindfulness and peacefulness and non-reactivity in doing it? How do you do it with other family members? How do you do it with all the demands, you know, driving the kids around and shopping and whatever the issues are? There's no shortage of it. And for you, your monastery is your home. And you're given practice opportunities on a silver platter. And so, now it doesn't have the immediate benefits or the immediate, rewards that some people have on retreats where, you know, things are quiet and peaceful relatively. And you can let go and relax. It's kind of like being, you can get very peaceful very quickly, kind of let go of your ordinary concerns, and it's like a great vacation. And there's a lot of advantage to going on retreats, a lot of benefits. But it's also maybe sometimes practice is better done in a householder situation. It's kind of like that's where the real muscles are going to be developed. So it's a matter of you kind of applying it there, and yes, you can do it there. There's lots of people who have done it in household lives. I found for me that I was a monastic first, and then I was a householder. And for me, monastic life was actually a lot easier. And in some ways, it was too easy for me. And I kind of slipped through the cracks and the challenges that some people have. And so it was only when I had kids that I was challenged in a way that I was never challenged in the monasteries. And so I remember once having this thought. I was talking with a friend, and I was saying, you know, I would like to be able to go. I'd like to go on a long retreat. And then I heard myself say that, and I said, why I want that is I want relief. And whereas I had the thought, but really, I'm given practice opportunities in a silver platter. It's just like, it's really rich for me. It's a little tiring, but it's rich. And I have to see my attachments, my fears, my sense, my self-identity, my all kinds of issues came up in that kind of situation. And to repeat myself a little bit, you know, I didn't have the rewards of the immediate peace that you get on retreat. But it created, I think, much more stable, mature kind of spiritual maturity in me. So, yes, you can do it.
Thank you.
And the Buddha is with you. So Linda's been trying over here. Is another mic over there? You have one?
So when Stephen Batchelor was here in March, he talked about something that he considered a big issue. And that was that craving is the cause of suffering. But then the Buddha talks about how birth, aging, sickness, and death are suffering. And so his real question was, how is craving related to birth, sickness, aging, and death? And as I thought about that, I thought that was kind of an interesting question, and I was wondering how you'd respond to that.
How is craving related to sickness?
Aging.
And death.
And death.
Well, aging is easy. Probably most of you are aging people. I mean, I think, aren't you? Who here is not aging? You're not aging? Even though you're thinning on top? It's growing back. It's growing back, huh? And who here is not going to die? Your hand's staying down now. So you know, there's a lot of craving, attachment, clinging to things that really affect people and cause a lot of suffering people as people lives change, and all kinds of unwanted change happens in people's lives. And it's very devastating for people because the things they cherish most are taken away from them. Sickness is one of those things. And so some of the suffering, or the core suffering that Buddhism addresses in relationship to the suffering of sickness, is not the sickness itself, but rather how we relate to the sickness. And not a few people have come to me with terrible tragedies have happened to them that really radically limited what they could do in their life. And they've said to me, as horrible as this thing was, I'm also grateful for this thing because I didn't realize how much I was attached and caught up in a particular mode, idea, way of being in the world. And now I have to really face that. It was hard to face it, but now I freed myself from that in a way that I wouldn't if I hadn't this kind of issue. And so there's, you know, and then old age as well. That's another big transition. A lot of things change radically in ways that are very disappointing, shocking, frightening for people. And so, again, what are we holding on to as we get older? Some people hold on to their youth, their identity. Some people hold on to being in control, being self-reliant. Some people cling to their fear of radical discomfort. The fear of death. Death also, dying also. I mean, there's a lot of craving and clinging that's connected to people's relationship to death and dying. And for some people, you know, it's like the greatest fear. And then you ask, what are you afraid of around dying? Some people say, well, it's not dying itself, but it's being in pain, losing control, not being able to take care of myself. It's, you know, so it's very important to ask ourselves in relationship to sickness, old age, and death, what are the things we're holding on to desperately? And can we loosen up the clinging, the attachments we have? Because without the loosening up, we're not going to be at peace. And so those things is really easy to see, I think. It's harder to see with birth. Though probably most of us here are the result of someone's craving. So birth usually is seen somehow or other in the background of birth. There's some kind of strong desire that was operating.
my birth, you know, but I just got born, right? I didn't crave getting born, we would think. Now, the Buddhist analysis of this takes into account the theory of rebirth. And so in the kind of mechanisms of rebirth that Buddhism kind of postulates, is that it doesn't explain it very well, the mechanism, but it's kind of like when one person dies, the consciousness of that person has a spin in it, has momentum in it. And that momentum in it, you know, it isn't like the consciousness continues, but it's kind of like if you have billiard balls, you know, the first one hits the second one, and the first one stops, and the second one continues the momentum. So, you know, it's kind of like consciousness hits each, you know, moves along from one person to the next. But the spin, the momentum that in that consciousness has grasping as part of it. So that when you die and there's grasping in that consciousness, it reaches forward to grab onto the next consciousness of the next life. So there's not going to be any rebirth unless there's that grasping of wanting to get born and consciousness. So in Buddhist theory, that's kind of the explanation of how birth comes from as great craving as part of it as well. So, you know, of the four you mentioned, I think, you know, three of them we can see in our own life pretty obviously. The fourth is that, you know, the more theoretical part of Buddhism. That make sense?
Yes. Gil, the explanations I heard for birth are a little more mundane than that. Just the act of giving birth is not the most pleasant situation with my understanding with women. And then also, once you're born, I mean, you got to start breathing, the body's got to start operating. We don't remember when we were born, but there's elements of not being pleasant to it.
I think the question wasn't so much is birth suffering, wasn't it? It was, what's the connection between birth and craving? Wasn't that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craving is the origin of suffering.
So that was the question I was trying to answer, was the craving part. There's a lot of pain involved in suffering, and you know, a lot of indignation. You know, like the first thing my son did when he was born was he peed all over his mom. You know, that wasn't a big deal, but in the scale of things, but just the beginning. Yes, please.
Yesterday you were talking about safety and and many elements of it, and today I saw a short article regarding safety, where someone was accused of putting their daughter in jeopardy on the high seas, and he responded to that by saying that life is so full of dangers and unexpected and random things that we can't really hide from it, and hiding from it is really a disadvantage. So we can't be in a sort of, as he said, a cotton-covered tunnel seeking safety all the time. And in light of what you said yesterday about how Buddhism helps us for safety, are these a contradiction? Is this a contradiction that I'm seeing and
I don't think so. I don't think so. And in terms of the sailing boat, there's a cliche that says a boat is safe in the harbor, but that's not what the boat was built for, to stay in the harbor. And you can be conventionally safe if you know from all kinds of dangers if you just stay in your apartment all day. Just getting in the car or even walking down the streets to come here is dangerous, right? Like yesterday, I told a story of my friend who was walking and got hit by a car in San Francisco. And there's a lot of dangers, and probably it could well be that driving that the 16-year-old girl who lives in Southern California. My guess is that she has a driver's license now. It's probably more dangerous to drive on the freeway in L.A. than in most solo sailing trips for a 16-year-old. So, where is the, how do we measure danger and how do we protect ourselves? Like my son, plays baseball. And some kid up in Marin County got a terrible brain damage from a ball that pitcher, the ball hit him in the head. So, should I keep my son out of baseball now? To protect him, to keep him safe from getting hit by a ball? Not only do they get injured, but people get killed sometimes playing baseball. It's pretty rare. Should I keep him from doing baseball? There's risk involved in life, and part of risk is knowing. Part of it is knowing these risks are involved, trying to lessen them, but then learning how to be wise about how do we relate to when the risk happens, when the danger happens. So, there's got to be where. Friday morning, my son woke up in pain in his eye, and took a while. He sent him to school, and school said you have to come and get him. And so we went to the doctor with him, and it took a while to figure out what's wrong, but he had a scratch on his cornea. It's not a big scale of things, right? But he got it at sleeping at night. Supposedly, we don't know how he got it. They say that most people die at bed, so stay out of bed. the point being that at some point in life, it's not about protecting ourselves, but understanding the trade-offs and willing to take some risks, and then learning how to be wise about how we are when the dangers actually strike. And so this is where a practice like mindfulness is so crucially important, because a parent's job is to protect kids, and we do the best we can, but we can't protect all of it, right? So my other son this spring broke his finger. I would have wished he didn't break his finger. He had a cast and all that. But these things happen. And so how do I relate to that broken finger, the fact that he broke his finger? Do I get anxious and upset? Do I call the school up and say he broke it at school and you should really kind of do something and prevent these kids from playing basketball without suits of armor? this is playing basketball with just, no protection at all. Just that shouldn't be done. Or do I understand, this is part of the risk of being a kid, the risk of being alive. The joy and the vitality, the engagement of life comes with certain risks, and that's the cost of it. And here he has a broken finger, and now we have to kind of just be relaxed about that and try to heal it the best we can and not be upset about it. And to teach my son how to see this as a character building for him. See, this is how he's going to learn how to deal wisely with the inevitable difficulties that he's going to face in his life. It was a big deal for him because it took him out of the baseball season. So it was very unfortunate. But again, I looked upon it as this is an important lesson for him to learn how to hold disappointment, how to hold, that he really wanted to do something and he couldn't do it. Now, how does he work with that? So how to be safe? There's a safety of and then they say, you know, that if you create too much safety, you're not so safe. I mean, the example that now they seem to say is, we have all this antiseptic stuff, right? We're sanitizing everything. And now it turns out that if you sanitize everything, then the immune system doesn't build up strong enough to really take care of the human being well. You need to have dirt for a strong immune system. And if you protect your kids too much from all what's going on in life, then you end up with kids who don't understand how to live wisely in this world, who think it's kind of the world is very different when it is, or are shocked. And so, you know, you don't want to protect people too much. You want to protect them just right. But we know that life comes with danger, and we can't protect ourselves from danger. Life comes with tragedy. We can't protect ourselves from all tragedy. Normally, conventionally, death is a tragedy. And I can't protect you from dying. No one can. You're going to have to face that. But the Buddha example is someone who died peacefully. He had done the inner work that allowed him the capacity to die at peace with the experience of dying. For him, it wasn't a tragedy to die. And so the choices people make, some people choose to take certain risks because that gives their life meaning or something. And then if the risk goes wrong, then hopefully they have the wisdom to how to hold that so they don't burden themselves with further suffering because of that. So even if this young girl had died at high C, I wouldn't want to judge. I'm not inclined to judge her life and her choices and what she did. She was following something that was really important for her dream, and I think people should follow their dreams to some degree, knowing there's risks involved. And you know, if she died, my hope for her, I hope that she didn't die, but my hope from her is that she already had the inner resources to face that challenge of a disaster at high sea with equanimity, with peace. My father was rescued in the same part of the world from broken mast as well. He was out there and the boat was half submerged and had to wait for a fishing boat to come and get him.
What was he doing then?
What?
What was he doing then?
Sailing. Same thing, high seas. Then the high seas, the big waves, the mast broke and hit the side of the boat. The boat started leaking. And it started sinking. It didn't sink all the way, and they had to wait for a fishing boat to come and get them. So these things happen. And I don't begrudge my father from that. I expect my father's going to die at sea. That's probably he's hoping for that. It's more important for him.
So, Gil, just to continue on this theme, because it's been very interesting to me, this story that he just shared. And then there was a young man, maybe 13, I think. He's climbed 5 of the 6 major mountains. You may have seen that story. But he's done it with his father. I want to digress a little bit. When I was a young man visiting relatives in Italy, it was in the Amalfi Coast, and I was in the water, and there was some concern that there were sharks out there, and there happened to be a family friend who was a Catholic priest there. He was fearful of going in the water, and I was being facetious, and I said, "Well, why are you afraid, Father? God will protect you, you know." And he said, "Yes, but one must not tempt the Lord." So there's this issue about tempting fate, and it's one thing as an adult to do that. I mean, I have flown into areas in different parts of the world that where there was conflict going on, and friends and family thought I was crazy. I was never harmed by any of that, but so to now take it as far as right action, is it right action for a parent who has many years of experience to allow a 16-year-old to follow their dream? I have some discomfort with that and haven't worked it through.
So,
it's following their dream, but they're 16 and they're alone. It's not like they're with the parental figure.
Yeah. So the issue for me is not whether they should or shouldn't, or what's. I don't know the details of the situation, the family, the people involved. But I think some of the principles of how to analyze a situation like that for me has to do with the issue of craving, of attachment, of what's the motivation behind wanting to do it. And I've seen parents push their kids because the parents' sense of self-identity was tied in the kids' success. And the kids absorb that. And it's all about being successful, being top of the world, being a star. And it's really, I think, disturbing to see the way that some kids are pushed by our society, by their parents, by all kinds of stuff, to step into kind of very egotistical kind of roles early in life. So if that's what's being fed to the kids, if that's what's motivating it, then I think it's irresponsible. I think it's kind of harmful to a whole society to see that kind of aggrandizement of the individual maybe going on. But I don't know if that was the case in this situation. I don't know enough about the situation. I don't know. I'm not inclined to want to judge these people without having more information. So I don't know. For a 16-year-old, for a 13-year-old to climb, I don't know. The kids are so different from each other. It's really remarkable. My kid is 12 now, and we had the school band did a performance the other night, and I saw all these middle school kids, and boy, are they different! The same age, and some of them are like look like they're ready to conquer the world, sassy and sexual and and some of them are still. With their teddy bears at bed at night. They're still little kids. And so I don't know, 16-year-old, what's a 16-year-old? There's such a range of what it means to be 16. Such a range.
The segue off the householder question. Drilling down on the conversation you had with Carla, I think it is. The challenge, as I see it, is one of a relationship with the teacher. My assumption is that as a householder, with all the tasks in the professional, you have to, my experience of spiritual practice is that I can't do it alone. So the image of the busy kitchen and the going off to work, How do you see an effective relationship with the teacher being an added task, both a spiritual task and a logistical task, the going to see the teacher once in a while, and the attentive task, I have to remember my path. How can a harried householder add that to the basket?
Well, the teacher thing. Well, luckily we're at 10:45. I have once in a while it's occurred to me to give a whole talk on the whole thing about teachers, but then I've done it many years ago, but I've actually been reluctant to do it because if I give a whole talk about teachers. Then people can have all these expectations on me, or something, so I've been felt kind of cautious around it, being such a big group we are here. So I apologize in the degree to which that's been a disservice to you, not covering this important topic. So maybe I should take it on one of these weeks this summer when I'm back. But what to say briefly for you? It's a good question, good concern, And all the questions today I appreciate a lot. There are many different ways in which teachers function in practitioners' lives. And it's important not to have a set idea they're supposed to look a certain way. And some people have a teacher who's very, very important for them, you know, maybe helps, you know, really changes their life in a dramatic way, but they never talk to the teacher. It's listening to the talks, being in their presence somehow, that's enough. Other people get a lot of access to a teacher, spend a lot of time with them, and it doesn't change them at all. Different people have different needs in terms of a teacher or student relationship. Some people need a lot more contact than others, or need a certain kind of contact. Student-teacher relationship, you know, every student-teacher relationship is different. It's not like any two are really the same. And some of it's just kind of mysterious. Some of it just has to do with circumstances. I mean, if a wonderful teacher happened to move in next door to you, then, you probably have much more access. But if, and those of you here in the Bay Area live in like one of the world's Buddhist meccas for teachers. I mean, there's so many. I mean, like we're like a dime a dozen here. you go down the street and there's another one. We have three Buddhist centers in Redwood City. We have Redwood City in Menlo Park and Palo Alto and Burlingame and, you know, just like in San Francisco, but gee, in Berkeley and just, you know, it just goes on, you know. And you go to other places in the world, and you know, they have to travel 200, 300, 400, 500 miles to be, you know, to find a teacher. So there's certain, you know, so there's kind of a mystery around it. I don't know if mystery is the right word, but a lot of it has to do with, you know, cause and condition, what comes together. I mean, haven't you ever wondered, you know, that something like, you know, if you hadn't gone to college where you went, if you'd gone to college in other state, you know, who would you have ended up being partnered with, you know, if that was your thing? You know, maybe if you got married or had found a committed relationship with someone and you spent some years together. But, you know, if I'd gone to that other college, I wouldn't have met that person. And probably there's someone out there in the world. There's someone out there who would have been that person for me if I'd gone to that place. Who is that person? You know, oh God, she says. So same thing with teachers, right? I mean, you know, there's probably a perfect teacher out there for you somewhere. But, you know, where is she? You know, you didn't go to that city. So I'm going on and on, but it's a great question. But one of the important ways of looking at this question for you is to ask yourself, what do you want in terms of a teacher? What do you feel would be helpful for you? And then look around to the teachers you know that are accessible to you and talk to them about it. Say, I have this wish in a teacher. This is what my situation is like. This is what I'm trying to do in my practice. And what do you think? Do you think that you can be a teacher in this way? Are there other people? Are there other ways? Am I missing something? Is some other approach that can be done? Bring it to a teacher and explore it, rather than keep it in questioning. So it should be it's a personal thing. And as you explore yourself, understand yourself personally, then you can go and present that personal side to it to some teachers. And if you are lucky to be in a place with a lot of teachers, then it's really good to go around and see different teachers and see who you have a rapport with. That feels like, and then if you feel rapport with someone, to go to them and say, you know, how can, you know, I have this interest in a teacher, this is my particular interest, and how can, is it possible to fulfill this interest around with you, or is this, how are you available, and things like that. And the fact that you're a householder with a busy life doesn't preclude the possibility of having a teacher that you work with. It doesn't have to be, you know, your life might mean that it's not so often. Maybe it's you see your teacher as often as you see your dentist. But hopefully you see your dentist. I mean, you figured that out. So, if you can do the dentist, you can do the teacher thing. So we should stop. I apologize. And I appreciate it. It's very meaningful for me to hear your concerns, your interests, and I hope that my answers were appropriate and also respectful. I had a lot of respect for them, but even though you laughed a little bit. And I hope you have some wonderful next few weeks. And we do have this tea now, especially if you're new. If you're welcome to stay. And in fact, if you're new here today, if you're at all inclined, I'd encourage you to just turn to the person next to you and say, "I'm new." And because this is a friendly group of people and would like to make you feel welcome here if you'd like to feel welcomed. So thank you all.